Arahato Samma Sambuddhassa Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Samma Sambuddhassa Aparuta De Sangamatasatavara Ye Sodavanta Bamujantu Sadhang. This next week is a retreat, and this course is a special gift, opportunity to have kind of a very good conditions for formal, what we call formal practice, meditation. And of course, this is a chance to develop, to keep the what we call the noble silence, the chance to refrain from unnecessary conversations, chit-chat, so forth, just to keep your attention inward. So this is kind of an excuse not to have to engage with others, because we're all supporting this practice. And being able to speak and chit-chat and talk, of course, it draws us out into all kinds of conditions that we can easily become obsessed with or upset by or whatever. So developing this sense of a noble silence is not like a dumb silence. It's to refuse to speak at all, just out of some rigid view of not talking and see noble silence as a determination not to speak in some kind of idealistic way. But we're developing wisdom rather than just trying to live up to ideals. So we have to use our own judgment when it's appropriate to speak and when it's not. So noble silence is something that is generous and welcoming rather than a kind of rigid adherence to the idea of not talking at all. And then you see others talking, you can feel very angry or upset because you see somebody else talking, and then you think they're breaking the noble silence, and then you're caught in aversion, resentment towards somebody else. So this is, but the important thing that for this retreat is of developing an opportunity to cultivate awareness. And so if one is upset by somebody else, what somebody else does or says, then the encouragement is to look at the experience of being upset rather than to carry that around and fulminate inwardly with anger and resentment. And because the important thing is the awareness rather than in rigid adherence to a kind of discipline and ideal that we might have about what a good meditation retreat should be. It's learning how to use convention without being attached to it. Like punya or wisdom is learning how to flow, to move, to respond to the experience of consciousness. So it's not rigidly adhering to ideas and then being very distressed when you can't support a particular ideal, or you feel that others aren't living up to your expectations. So when you're living in community, we affect each other a lot. So we have ideas about what we should be, and then when we don't live up to these ideals, then we get upset. So in the First Noble Truth, the dukkha is, there is this dukkha. So being upset because somebody doesn't live up to your ideal is, what is that? And so you begin to investigate, why am I upset because of somebody else? And then you can kind of begin to see, notice the view you have about the ideals you have about what monks or nuns should be, and which are ideals. You know, you have the ideal forms. They're valid. They're inspiring. They're beautiful. But they are just ideas, in other words. They're not living, breathing human beings. Ideals, none of us are ideals. And emphasizing this because in the spiritual life, in the religious world, people get so, are looking for the ideal teacher or the ideal situation, the monastery, the ideal form, the master, or the pure-hearted one, or the great one. And so and we're always being disappointed because the idols easily fall off of pedestals, you know, then they crash and they break. But notice that awareness, mindfulness, is not an ideal state, isn't it? We're not saying you have to think a certain way and feel a certain way and only, you know, be at your very best all the time according to how things should be if everything was perfect. But we're noticing the way it is, the suchness, the as-isness of this moment. And so this moment right now is not an ideal, is it? It is what it is. Maybe an ideal moment, you can imagine, an ideal moment is where you're really blissed out, you know, and free from all suffering. You can imagine an ideal moment in which the very best that you can think is happening to you. But right now, is anybody in that state with perfect bliss and happiness as you imagine you'd like to be? As an idea, or is it the way it is? How are you right now? What is it now? The way it is now. Now then, this is turning our attention to just looking here. What's going on in here? Or physically, the experience of just having a physical body, conscious physical body that's sensitive right now is like this. So you have these words like as is, and Pali, the da-da-da, they have a special word for as is, the suchness, da-da-da. And this, in English, it comes out suchness, which is never really made much sense to me, but now I understand what it is through da-da-da. Then as-isness, that's a bit strange, isn't it? As-isness. But we're pointing to an intuitive attention rather than a logical definition. So the pointing is this awakened sense of awake up, pay attention. And then the way it is like this. So the way it is right now, the body's like this. So it brings attention just to the fact that the body here, this physical body that you refer to as Ajahn Sumedho, it's like this. And it, you know, sitting in this high seat, and the pressure of sitting, and seems all right, no great problems. But I'm aware of there's an awareness of the experience of sitting. And then of the breath is like this, or the mood, emotional state I'm in now is like this. I refer to the sound of silence. The sound of silence is here and now, it's this way. And so this, what I'm doing is reflecting, kind of awakening, just observing the experience that I'm having at this moment is like this. I'm not blissed out. I'm not kind of in any extreme state. It's not being extreme, not being high as a kite or being depressed in the pits of hell, but just sitting, breathing, sound of silence like this. So there's an attention, a sustainable attention that we begin to appreciate as the way of non-suffering. Now getting to recognize that this, that to realize this, it's so ordinary that we don't recognize it usually, we don't appreciate it because we're conditioned for extremities. Just think about yourself, how you're emotionally conditioned through your culture. And that when you think about yourself as a personality, you think in terms of extremities, of being, good or bad, or beautiful or ugly, or pleasing or displeasing, or right or wrong. We want interesting things to do. Just sitting here with the sound of silence, that's not interesting. I'd like to have kind of an angelic chorus come in. Hallelujah chorus. Kind of with angels and devadas and all that. It'd be a fantastic light show of bliss. That would be fantastic, wouldn't it? To be able to sit through this retreat, being entertained the whole time with the extraordinary beauty and extremities of sight, sound, smell, taste, touch, and thought. There's one thing right after another for a whole week. I wonder what that would be like. Or the fear that the whole week is just going to be pits of hell, you know, just depression, despair, not getting anywhere, can't do it, too screwed up anyway, hopeless, the rest are okay, but I'm no good, and then you could create a whole week of being utterly miserable for yourself. That's the other extreme. But they, in terms of this moment, it's neither heaven nor hell, but it is the way it is. So in this word ordinary, the Lungpa Cha was always using, when he was talking about the Dhamma, he would use the in Thai called Tamada. And it means just ordinary, you know, it's nothing special, not the best, not the worst, it's like this, just ordinariness. Because ordinariness, we usually don't bother with it. We think it's mediocre or it's not important. That fulfillment and happiness lie in attaining extremes like great success and great peace. And we even put nibbana and arahantship on an extremity of high attainment. So we think of an arahant as a really extreme kind of attainment that somebody has got through some kind of extreme practice. So we think of an arahant as an extreme, where when you contemplate, arahant is totally ordinary. I'm just reflecting for you right now. Looking at it a different way. You know, you think of an arahant oftentimes as having psychic powers and being able to do fantastic things and read people's minds and float in the air and walk on the water and do all kinds of feats, you know. And so these are extremities, extremes, psychic phenomena, magic and fantasy. Or when you contemplate an arahant in terms of the 10 fetters, the 10 sanyojana, you realize that it's completely ordinary, tamada, this here and now. Not having to be anybody or become or attain or achieve or get rid of anything or... So, in this way, it's not like an attainment at all. It's not like that. It's like a PhD in meditation practice. That's an attainment, isn't it? To get a PhD is an attainment. It's not tamada, it's not ordinary to have a PhD. They have to work hard for it and do all kinds of things to get through the system, to get the PhD. Or in terms of practice, Buddha Dhamma, it's through non-attainment, not through becoming the best monk and the best nun and being able to do everything perfectly and having only pure thoughts all the time and just being, you know, full of love and joy and radiance as some ideal. It's being able to open and be open and with the flow of experience as it is, which much of our life is just ordinary. Sitting, standing, walking, lying down, breathing, sound of silence, or moods, emotional moods, just blah, nothing much going on. How do you feel? Okay. So then we can think, well, it sounds pretty dreary, you know, because those other things are more inspiring, to be kind of blissed out, flying in the air, reading people's minds, and being able to go up into the heavenly realms and consort with the Devadas and the Brahma Lokas, and those are feats, you know, that's not tamada, that's fantastic. And that's interesting, too. like in Thailand, they're more interested in ghosts than in enlightenment. I mean, about ghosts and spirits, and these are more interesting than the breath, inhaling. Because ghosts are interesting, because they're extremities, and devadas, and all these are very interesting. What I'm doing is a reflection. I'm not trying to convert you to my way of thinking. I'm just using this time to reflect on what practice is, or what it really this is. And I'm just sharing what I am experiencing right now with you. We notice that so much of our life is not extreme, you know, it's just walking from here to there, or putting on the robes, taking off the robes, sitting, standing, walking, lying down. Just brushing teeth, shaving, and bathing, and ordinariness of daily life, eating food, washing the alms bowl, drying it, cleaning the room and whatnot. Just ordinary, mundane, banal activities that we can see are not at all part of real meditation. We think of meditation as sitting for, you know, really sitting and getting your samadhi, and really developing the samadhi, and being able to walk and really mindfully in a formal way for an hour without your mind wandering once, just totally concentrated on your feet, right, left, toe, onward for a whole hour. And really getting some, I had really good walking practice last hour, just super duper, and your mind didn't stray one bit. And then we think that's where it's at. And then some monk comes along and says, somebody wants to speak to you on the telephone. God, let's get rid of all telephones. If I were king of the world, I'd destroy all the telephones, all the computers, all the cameras, all the televisions. We just have a really, you know, really good monastery where there was none of this stuff going on, and we'd just get down to the real practice: sitting 1 hour, walking 1 hour, sitting the next, walking, sitting, till the end of our lives. That's the ideal, maybe. And we won't allow this stressed out society we live in to come and touch us. We'll lock the gates. We'll have to be very careful who we let in this place. Not to let any screwballs inside, you know, any destructive, disturbing, distressing people in. Only if they're bona fide sotapannas. And then we're going to get every life down to where it's not, you know, we can just really practice, really get our practice together. And that's what I want, a place where I can really get my practice together. So then, that's an ideal again, isn't it? Getting one's practice together. So being aware of that is some kind of idea we have about what practice is. Really good practice, serious practice, is, you know, formal. An ordinary life, walking from here back to your kuti or whatever, that's not practice. Putting on your robe, or that, eating, or answering the telephone, or having to deal with somebody, a guest that come in the monastery. That's not practice. That's just getting in the way of my practice. Or isn't it part of the flow of experience? Consciousness is this experience of a flowing. Things flow through our consciousness. And we, you know, if we try to control that, then we're caught up in the sense of our own views and opinions and how things should be. Maybe very, you know, attached to very good ideals. But we'll never be liberated through that, because life will always, when we lose control, we have no way of dealing with losing control. When unwanted, unexpected things happen, when things don't go right, when it's a bad day, when the neighbors make too much noise. Or is that part of the flow of our experience? And so in this intuitive way, recognize it, that I like to describe intuitive awareness or sati sampajanya as that includes everything. So it includes the extremities. I'm not trying to get rid of extremity and think mediocrity and ordinariness is we've just got to make ourselves ordinary. I've got to make myself an ordinary monk, not a special monk. So then, you know, like being Ajahn Sumedho, that's being special, isn't it? Nobody else is Ajahn Sumedho. And being an abbot, being teacher, all these are special kind of titles and positions, special positions. And then I can see, I don't care about titles or positions, or I don't want to be abbot, I don't want to be a teacher, I just want to be an ordinary bhikkhu. And then I can make even the idea of being an ordinary bhikkhu into an ideal again. So then, on that level, you just go around in circles. I don't want to be an abbot. I don't want to be a teacher. I don't want to be an important monk. I don't want to be special. I just want to be an ordinary bloke, ordinary guy, just an ordinary monk. Just a nobody. And then we can hold on to that as an ideal. And then it becomes an extreme again. Being ordinary can become extreme, because we're making it into an ideal rather than trusting in the awareness and recognizing the way things really are. So in the Buddha is the knower of the world, or the worlds. So we're having a good Dharma discussion this evening at tea in the bhikkhus, and talking about the pure subject. So we were, this is interesting because, you know, in terms of experience right now, there's a subjective experience going on in terms of here. And yet, we have this idea of oneness or no, or anatta or no self. So we can hold the idea there's no self as an idea. That the Buddha said, anatta, there's no self. And then we grasp the idea of no self. If we're a Buddhist, then we've got to believe in anatta, no self. But then what is it that is aware right now in terms of the experience of this moment? And so asking this question, is that a self? So then, but you can't get behind it, isn't it? The awakened state, awareness, is you can't be aware of being aware. You can only be aware. And this is where you're putting this, you know, when you take it to this center point, this point of pure awareness that you can't get beyond. You can't watch it. You can't find out who is it that's aware, but there's awareness. It's like seeing, you know, I can see, but my eyes can't see themselves. And I can't see my own eyes at this point. You know, I can, they're seeing, but I can't see my eyes. Now you can see my eyes, but I can't. So what's that about? You know, but it's not point if he doesn't, who cares about, there's no point in seeing one's own eyes, is there? As long as they see, that's good enough. That's all you need, that's all that's necessary to find out who I am. Am I the ultimate reality, or am I, you know, wanting to find a name for awareness in terms of some concept that I can say my true nature is, or letting go of trying to conceive myself, or that desire to know something, into the pure state of attention, which is prior to thought or concept. So this pure awareness, and the word sati sampajanya, intuitive awareness, is what we mean by the Bhutto or the Buddha. So this is just the way that Theravadins speak, and these are concepts too. Buddha and Bhutto, and that is another, just another word. True. Not trying to say it's a, that that's what we are. I'm the Buddha, because then I'm grasping the idea of Buddha again, isn't it? I'm grasping a view about Buddha, and then thinking, and then trying to apply it to myself. Or is the, when we use this sense of refuge, Bhutang Saranang Gacchami, the refuge, the Saranang is, to me, this sense of awakened awareness, which is an imminent act. It's an immediate attentiveness to the present. So it's very natural, ordinary ability we have, but can be completely not appreciated because we're usually caught up with trying to, when we are paying attention, we're trying to, we aren't aware of that. We're all usually thinking about something else or trying to figure out something. You know, what is he talking about? How should I practice meditation? What technique should I use to practice meditation with? Should I get the samadhi? Should I do samatha first and then vipassana? These are the old dreary questions you get in the Theravada world. How much samadhi do you need before you can do vipassana? And you know, if I have a lot of psychological problems, do you think I need to do therapy first before I can do vipassana? And on like this. So then these are, you know, these are coming from the wanting to know who I am and what, what I should be doing, where what I'm pointing to is being aware of this, of how we create ourselves. What should I, how should I practice? Should I do samatha first, or should I just do pure vipassana? These are thoughts, aren't they? These are, and the pure subject, then, and we trust in this awareness, we're aware of that as a doubt, as a question, as wanting to know, wanting to know what should I do next. So this is you know, the confusion we find in the meditation circles that I tend to get involved with, because people are always, there's so much effort in and so many views and opinions about what, how you should practice, what technique is the best, or, you know, should I do Mahayana practice, or is Theravada good enough, or Vajrayana, or Dzogchen, or Zen, or on and on like this. Ajahn Sumedho's method. Or, I mean, I'm getting stuck with having people saying, I do Ajahn Sumedho's method, which don't really consider it a method. It's like the attention, the invitation to awaken. Very simple. And then the thinking, what do I do next? After I wait, what do I do? So, because we feel frustrated, don't we? We feel ill at ease unless we've got something to do. You know, I've got to do something this week. I want to, you know, feel I'm getting somewhere. So this is another thing we're creating. I feel very ill at ease unless I've got certain directions and I know what to do next. And then I feel better, you know, if you tell me what to do, and then I'll do that. And it makes me, and we can be aware of these kind of feelings we have, the insecurity we feel when we don't know what to do next. And wanting to have some kind of certitude in our practice, a plan, a recipe, an outline that we follow. Not that any of these things are wrong, like methods or plans or anything, but just getting to the very, get to start out from the pure present is what I'm encouraging, rather than starting out with the grasping of views about practice, and operating from the views about yourself as reality. So in this sati sampajanya, it is a very simple attention, a listening, an openness, a receptivity, and I use this word, welcoming all that is happening right now, whether you like it or not, whether it's pleasant or horrible. So it all belongs. So that's a reflection. And when we get into ideals of practice, then we get into very kind of controlling and divisive tendencies, you know. Don't slam the door. Don't do this. Don't upset me. You're speaking too loudly. Everything, planes are going overhead, and on and on. We get into feeling frustrated because we have very strict ideas about what we want, and then when the world doesn't cooperate, we feel frustrated by that. And this is where the The Four Noble Truths help in this dukkha, rather than trying to create the perfect environment, perfect situation where we've got a soundproof temple, completely soundproof. Even though the planes are overhead, it's not really that soundproof though. But they are on a flight path from Luton Airport. And we should have maybe sell the monastery and go to another place that isn't on the flight path of any airport. In order to get the perfect place. And then we have to spend all the next time trying to look for a place where the perfect place where there's no flight paths. And on like this. There's always something, in the way. So intuitive awareness includes the sound of the airplanes, the good, the bad, the stillness, the peace, the chaos. And that both external and internal. Being able to totally welcome and accept your own confusion or frustration or anger, resentment, fear, confusion and messiness and stupidity and all these mental states that we really don't want, we'd like to get rid of when we go back to into being a personality that holds to ideas. So in recognizing that this Buddha as the pure subject, Butto, it's a transcending of the conditions. Now this you don't have to believe, but this is for contemplation. And they talk about the unconditioned and the conditioned. And so the unconditioned, or they call the amata dhamma, or the deathless, that can only be now, isn't it? And so to tune in to the deathless is to pay attention in the simple, imminent attentiveness. So trust that. Trust in that very simple ability. It's trustworthy. That's why it's a refuge in the Bhutang Sarnangachami. It's a refuge. It's the place, as you begin to realize and appreciate it more, it is the refuge. And no matter what's happening to you in terms of conditions internally or externally. Because it allows you to be aware of your emotional states, of your fears and desires. I mean, it includes your habits, your good habits and bad habits, and anger and greed and lust and fear and jealousy and worry and all the rest. It all belongs, all includes, because your relationship to it is the Buddha knowing the Dhamma. Buddha sees the truth of the way it is. So this is just an encouragement to, rather than the striving style of trying to get samadhi and through controlling everything, what I feel is, what works for me, what I find has benefited my practice, conventional my practice, of course, is not striving to control or attain or get rid of. but trusting in the presence, the pure presence of being. And that doesn't mean other than paying attention, awaking, that awakened attention now, attentiveness to whatever is you're experiencing. Now, on every level, from physical, external to internal, emotional, sense, impressions, whatever, good or bad, coarse or refined. So, like intuition is the ability to, an intuitive moment includes. So, intuitive intelligence is it's not divisive. When you start thinking, when you get caught in thinking, and then you start dividing everything up. There's right and wrong, good and bad, what should be and what shouldn't be. That's the way thought works, isn't it? When you identify with thinking and try to think yourself into enlightenment, you will never make it. Because it's an impossible task to think yourself into enlightenment. You can delude yourself by convincing yourself you're enlightened, but that's not it. Because thinking itself is a function that appears in consciousness. It's functional, and so it's limited. You can't trust, thinking is a very limited function of the mind, where intuition is profound. It's deep, it's profound. So it's not, when you try to understand everything through thought, you remain on the surface. You distort reality all the time. You're out of touch because you're filtering experience always through ideas and concepts and words and so forth. So you're not with the flow of experience as is. So you're always kind of shuffling the deck all the time, or rearranging the furniture, or just trying to make things better. If you can control everything to make everything better so you feel safer and happier. Or, in an intuitive awareness, it includes the worm in the apple, snake in the garden, fly in the ointment, or the airplanes on the flight path from Luton, they belong, or the lawnmower, or the whatever. So this is reflecting in order to encourage an attitude that I found beneficial. This is what I can share from my own experience. In the terms control, I found, I used to be really into a control freak, as they say, when I first started meditation. I really wanted to control everything, so, because I realized that if I, I'd get so upset by things when I felt out of control. I'd long to just be in a situation where I could just kind of hide away and just be alone and not be bothered with the world. And so there's a strong kind of longing to disappear and to in a place where I couldn't have to be responsible for anything. I could just where I would be taken care of, like in Thailand, you go to some monasteries and you do this Khao Hong practice. You go into a kuti and then they bring you food. You don't have to go out on alms round, and you can just meditate, and you don't talk. Everybody's keeping a noble silence, and you just live your life, sitting 1 hour, walking 1 hour, sitting 1 hour. That's what you're supposed to be doing anyway. And this was certainly, I like doing this. But in terms of being able to live my whole life like that, I've never been able to make that possible. And Ajahn Chah was always kind of, he wasn't encouraging me in that direction. It was much more towards awareness in the flow of life in the monastic form that we use, in the Dhamma Vinaya, using that to be aware of what's going on. And to have this sense of opening to it and recognizing it and knowing, rather than just getting caught up with preferences and with ideals and wanting to control things and fearing and really resenting anything that threatened my practice or my tranquility. Or why? You should think Ajahn Chah was the big obstruction to my tranquility. Because he wouldn't let me do what I want. But this retreat, recognize that we're making it, you know, putting these kind of conditions, setting these conditions for this retreat. Just do that, follow along with it. And then observe what happens. And trust, this sense of witness, or pure subject, or puto, this knowing that's like this right now, this is the feeling of the present. This is where the body is, the breath. And in this open to the present, then it includes. So then one can move within this spaciousness. So what should I do next? Should I start with the breath first and then do the body sweeping? Or with the sound of silence? Or should I start with the sound of silence and then go to the breath and develop anapanasati and then do the sweeping through the feelings, or should I just do pure awareness, you know? And so then you get caught in, what should I do next? And then I think for you should do anapana first. Oh, thank you, Ajahn Sumedho. When somebody told me what to do, I don't trust myself, and this wanting to be told what to do, I don't want to, I don't even notice that. I mean, you're the teacher, Ajahn Sumedho, and you've been at it for years. You're the meditation master. You tell me, because I don't know. I'm just a neophyte, just a new person, not an expert like you are. What's that coming from? Where's that? So you begin by opening to that, to just recognizing how you conceive yourself as being ignorant and don't know what to do, and project onto me the sense of he's the master and he knows what's good for me. These are creations of your mind, aren't they? So being aware of this is very direct. Isn't it? Very, very direct noting. It's like this. Wanting to know what to do next. left is like this. Feeling confused about what should I do is like this. Just being with the way it is and trusting yourself at this moment to just know, right now I'm totally confused, I haven't a clue what to do, like this. Then this point that includes everything, the present moment that includes. And once you appreciate that, then you can just trust yourself. In there's always the body is here, isn't it? What's here and now? The physical body, it's always here and now. As long as it's alive, in my experience of life, it's always, the body's always here. And then the breath is always something happening there. Inhale, exhale. It's the way it is. And then there's awareness of sensation. You know, there's a tension or itching or pressure or even neutral sensation. Just being aware of your body and the experience of sitting before the physical sensations become extreme. I mean, so this attitude of learning to pay attention, the present moment is the body is now, the breath is now, the sound of silence is now, the mood you're in is now, isn't it? Whatever moods are, you know, very fluctuating and changeable, but whatever it is right now, this is, it's now. I mean, being aware of the state of mind or the physical presence or the breath or the silence. So when you're doing this, then you are putting yourself in that pure subjectivity or the Bhutto. And trust that. I keep reiterating this sense of, because it's something you can trust, the more you recognize it and appreciate it. But it is so ordinary that it's easily overlooked because we're conditioned to look for something more than that. To have, you know, an attainment of some sort, to get the samadhi before we do the vipassana, and get this before we do that, and we're very conditioned to think and experience life through our thoughts and our conditioned perceptions of life. So it is an act of faith, sadda, or trust. And a confidence as we begin to explore it and recognize and work from this pure presence, awakened awareness. So this evening we can usually do our midnight bit, and then tomorrow we'll start the formal retreat at 8:30. But noble silence, please. Just to encourage this is. Sense of not distracting each other with conversations, and then we can all support each other also in this. And, you know, we by not speaking to each other unless it's urgent, then it's supporting. However, I'm immune to all this. I'm the exception to the rule. I don't have to keep silent. And even though I would like to, but on Sunday I'm going to a celebration up in Birmingham at the Thai temple there. Another few things. But don't let this upset you or distress you. Just recognize it's just the way it is. When you Ajahn Sumedho, this is the way it is. So I offer this as a reflection.